So I want to talk this morning about what fish have to do with faith. And it turns out, I hope I will convince you by the end of this presentation, they have a lot to do with faith and what our lives here at Drift Creek Camp might be. Fish show up pretty frequently in the Bible. You don't have to get very far. In the first chapter, the first animate life on earth shows up early in Genesis, and it's fish. God said, let the water teem with living creatures. And there are many other occurrences of fishiness throughout the Bible, and we'll touch on some of those stories and images. But I also want to ask, what can fish teach us? One thing I think fish can show us, and like this, in this way, they're like many other creatures we share Earth with, they show us the meaning of community and dependence, that we're all in this together. Fish was a primary source of protein for the villages along the Sea of Galilee and Mediterranean coastline. Fish were a source of sustenance. They fed bodies, but at least in one story, fish also helped keep people around to hear an important teaching. It's hard to listen when you have a growling belly. I think we might start smelling cinnamon rolls. So fish are not just a source of sustenance, but I think they're in some ways spiritual food also. And fish didn't only feed families. Oh, and these are two of the common species that might have been captured in the Sea of Galilee at the time of Jesus and the disciples and the other fishers in that region. Fish didn't only feed families. In one story, fish helped meet the temple tax burden. You all probably know the story of the coin in the fish's mouth. Jesus said to Peter, go to the lake and throw out your line. Take the first fish you catch, open its mouth, and you will find a 4-drachma coin. Take it and give it to them for my tax and for yours. This is an interesting story on several fronts. Jesus asked Peter to go do this, and what tools did Peter have at hand? Who knew what kind of job Peter had before he dropped out of productive society and became a follower of Jesus? Anyone know what Peter did before he followed Jesus? Fisherman. He knew how to catch fish, so that's what Jesus sent him to do when there was a need. Jesus didn't ask him to build a wooden box and look inside that box for a coin. He didn't ask Peter to sew a shirt and look in the pocket for a coin. Peter wasn't a carpenter and he wasn't a tailor. He was a fisherman. And Jesus had him use the skills he had. The coin that Peter found was a figurative and a real symbol of the empire's power. The image on this coin was essentially a god, and people of that day were willing to do terrible things to obtain its power. Things are not much different today. Think of the things we're willing to do for money, the compromises, the delay of the good. We're willing to sacrifice many good things for these coins. But in this story, all the power that money represents was contained in the mouth of a humble fish. And it's fun to think about what this might really mean. Fish can be very hard to catch. They can be amazingly elusive. Yet the fish in this story came willingly, surrendering this treasure. It didn't have to. The might of Caesar's armies couldn't have captured that fish if that fish didn't want to be captured. Force would not have worked. Yet the fish came willingly to Peter. It's interesting to think about. Fishing at the time of Jesus was a communal effort, and in some places it still is. It requires teamwork. Everyone had to pull their weight. Sounds like running camp. And fishing was seasonal. If you fish, you had to trade at other times. You had to maintain relationships with others who supplied other needs at other times of the year. The cycle was to catch, to dry, and to trade. And this was also the cycle that Native American communities here on the northwest coast of North America shared. Salmon were, and are in a few remaining places, a way of life based on a need for a faithful supply of food entering the rivers every fall, and also part of a system of generosity. This is true for the coastal villages on the Bristol Bay region of southwest Alaska. Some of you may have seen the National Geographic article last year about the salmon of Bristol Bay and the importance of those fish, not just to the people, but to the wildlife and plants and nature of that region. And here at Drift Creek, they mean something special too. In some ways, salmon exemplify the meaning of commitment and sacrifice. Salmon don't just travel to coastal streams like Drift Creek or the tributaries of Bristol Bay. They also go all the way to interior Idaho, and they used to go to Nevada. Here's a stream in the middle of Idaho that salmon swim 1,000 miles to get to from the ocean. Salmon should show us that some things are worth struggling for. I'm sure you all know the amazing story, the journey that salmon go through, returning from the oceans back to the headwater streams where they were born. Their young go to the ocean and come back again. In many ways, the salmon connect the mountains to the oceans, just like the rains fall, the winter snow, and the spring thaw that sends it all back rushing to the ocean. These rivers start in the very headwaters of our mountains, and snow melts and eventually runs to the sea. And the people who feel a connection with salmon and the relatives of the steelhead chase those fish with a crazed passion, putting up with winter weather and discomfort. Conrad, is this a picture of you? No. What are your fishing friends? People are willing to do this just for a chance to get a glimpse of the wildness in the eye of a steelhead. And fish can remind us of the meaning of wonder. And wonder is a way of seeing the beauty in things. And salmon are an invitation to wonder. Henry David Thoreau called wonder a glimpse into the infinite extent of our relations. And in many ways, the eye of a steelhead is a portal into the mystery of life. I just love this picture. I had to show it again. And if you haven't noticed, almost all these photos are from Conrad Gall, sitting in the back row. If you haven't met Conrad, you need to. So wonder can't help but make us generous. When we connect with that infinite extent, whether it's seeing a salmon leaping the falls, or the tiny fist of a newborn baby, or the whirl of a pool in the forest, the gratitude that swells in our hearts opens us to the other. And this, I think, is what Jesus was referring to when he said to love one another as I've loved you, to share in the generosity of community. So here in this place, in Drift Creek Camp, one aspect of that sharing is the sharing that we do when we provide the place, the witness, and the nurturing of our programs. Whether it's catching fish down by the creek or gathering for camp, everyone loves to play in the water, making crafts and prints and paper in the craft center, learning to identify plants and birds. It's a way for us to share that wonder and that generosity. So fish are also a symbol of the resurrection, a symbol of the Lord's Supper. So we've all heard the resurrection fishing story, and I'll read it again. After this, Jesus appeared to the disciples, this time at the Tiberias Sea, the Sea of Galilee. This is how he did it. Simon Peter, Thomas, nicknamed Twin, Nathanael from Cana in Galilee, the brothers Zebedee, and two other disciples were together. Simon Peter announced, "I'm going fishing." The rest of them replied, "We're going with you." They went out and got in the boat. They caught nothing that night. When the sun came up, Jesus was standing on the beach, but they didn't recognize him. Jesus spoke to them. "Good morning. Did you catch anything for breakfast?" They answered, "No." He said, "Throw the net off the right side of the boat and see what happens." They did what he said. All of a sudden, there were so many fish in it, they weren't strong enough to pull it in. Then the disciple Jesus loved said to Peter, "It's the master." When Simon Peter realized it was the master, he threw on some clothes, where he was stripped for work, and dove into the sea. The other disciples came in by boat, for they weren't far from land, 100 yards or so, pulling along the net full of fish. When they got out of the boat, they saw a fire laid and with fish and bread cooking on it. Jesus said, "Bring some of the fish that you've just caught." Simon Peter joined them and pulled the net to shore, 153 big fish. And even with all those fish, the net didn't rip. Jesus said, "Breakfast is ready." Not one of the disciples dared ask, "Who are you?" They knew it was the master. Then Jesus took the bread and gave it to them. He did the same with the fish. This was now the third time that Jesus had shown himself alive to his disciples since being raised from the dead. So I love the fact that they count the fish, and I hadn't ever paid attention to that until I read this book, The River Wide by David James Duncan. And if you've read that book, you know what he comments on here. It's the fact that when the resurrected Christ appeared on the shore of the Sea of Galilee and directs forlorn and skunked disciples to the famous catch, we learned that the net contained not a boatload of fish, nor about 150, nor over a gross, but precisely 153. This is, it seems to me, and I'm reading David James Duncan here, this is, it seems to me, one of the most remarkable statistics ever computed. Consider the circumstances. This is after the crucifixion and the resurrection. Jesus is standing on the beach, newly risen from the dead. It is only the third time the disciples have seen him since the nightmare of Calvary. And yet we learn that in the net there were great fishes numbering precisely 153. How was this digit discovered? Mustn't it have happened thus? Upon hauling the net to shore, the disciples squatted down at that immense writhing fish pile and started tossing them into a second pile, painstakingly counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, all the way up to 153, while the newly risen Lord of creation, the sustainer of their beings, he who died for them and for whom they would gladly die, stood waiting, ignored, till the heap of fish was quantified. It's a funny way to look at it. And later, he closes, David James Duncan closes that chapter by saying, and considering that those disciples huddled over the pile of fish, another possibility occurs to me. Perhaps they paid the fish no heed. Perhaps they stood in circle, adoring their Lord, while he, the all-curious son of his all-knowing dad, counted them all himself. Fish can have an amazing power over people. So we're talking about resurrection. Salmon, more than any other creature, illustrates so beautifully that death is not the end. Salmon die after they spawn. As they enter freshwater, they commit all of their energy to growing their eggs and milk and making it upriver to the spawning ground. So much so that there is little left to spare at the end of the journey, and they can no longer maintain and support their own immune systems, and they begin to deteriorate. If you've been here in the fall and past, you've probably walked along the creek and seen and smelled dying salmon. But this death is a gift to the life around them and in nursery streams. That dying and the decomposing of that flesh supports the caddisfly that crawl on the bottom of the streams, that feed baby salmon, that also will feed directly on those carcasses and the eggs of those adults. It supports bird life. It supports mammals like this wily Arctic fox. Of course, it supports the gorillas, and most famously, the brown bears. Another great photo by Conrad Gao, and I see it's cut off the side of the slide here. Even the vegetation carries the signal of the gift of the salmon lifeblood. Biochemists can trace the isotopes that came in from the ocean in the bodies of salmon and detect them in the vegetation growing along salmon streams. The bears will pull the carcasses up there. The bears will leave their own droppings along the stream, and that nourishes the plants that grow along the streams. And so you can find the trace of salmon in the plants, in the berries that grow along these streams. This tree along Drift Creek took root hundreds of years ago, and you don't have to go back too many tree generations to be back in the time of Jesus. So there are echoes of the salmon runs that sustain the native villages along Drift Creek in this cedar tree today. Molecules that bear the signature of carbon and nitrogen that were brought in from the ocean in bodies of salmon lived and died here, giving life to multiple generations of people, animals, birds, and plants. And so we here today are part of a long line of generosity that has grown, been fostered, and sustained in this river canyon. From the salmon to the native villages before us, the cedars, the bears, the eagles, the thimbleberries, the ancient fungi, we're part of a long chain. The sharing we do today is different in many ways from the sharing that was done in the ecosystem for thousands of years before our arrival. But in many ways, it's the same. We still work together. We gather every year for this retreat. We gather every summer. Counselors come, give up precious time of other summers to share with our children. We provide for the next generation with our generosity and nurturing. We experience wonder and help each other see the beauty that's sometimes not obvious. We use the gifts we're given, whatever they are. We help each other resist the temptations of power. And we know that death is not the worst that can happen. Death is not the end. We know that resurrection happens. This picture of a Chinook, I think it's a Chinook, swimming through a bubble screen. And that's what we believe here at Drift Creek, that resurrection happens. That is the end.